Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, both featuring best-selling author W. Bruce Cameron. You'll hear first the interview which I just recorded about W. Bruce Cameron's most recent book, The Dogs of Christmas. And then out of the archives, you'll hear the conversation I recorded with him several years ago about his first best-selling book, A Dog's Purpose. Stay with us for the morning show here on WGTD. I have a feeling that many of you know the name W. Bruce Cameron. He is the best-selling author of A Dog's Purpose, a really huge book. And he is also well-known for its best-selling sequel, A Dog's Journey. And I am so excited to be able to reconnect now with W. Bruce Cameron to talk about his book called The Dogs of Christmas. It is an absolutely lovely novel in which we meet a young man named Josh who finds his relatively simple life turned upside down with the unexpected arrival of a pregnant dog, and then that dog's pups or other puppies that suddenly find themselves in his life. And it's nothing he's prepared for, nothing he's ever experienced before, but he manages to embrace this unexpected new reality in his life with surprising success. And indeed, it is a heartwarming and inspiring story in so many, many respects. And I'm very excited to be able to speak now with W. Bruce Cameron about his latest book. W. Bruce Cameron, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to be talking with you again.
Great.
I love the dedication of the book to the people all over the world who have opened their hearts and their homes to orphaned animals. I thought that would be a really good place to start. You obviously have a great love of animals yourself, and particularly dogs, but I wonder if this matter of taking in orphaned animals resonates with you on some kind of personal level due to maybe personal experience or other ways in which you've come to really appreciate what a loving gesture it is when somebody does this.
Oh, yeah. I would say that the message of the Dogs of Christmas is a question. And the question is, do we rescue animals or do they rescue us? As you put it very succinctly and well when you summed up the plot of the book. You've got a young man named Josh who is isolated and alone. He sort of lives like a mountain man up in Colorado, in Evergreen, Colorado. And then everything changes. His life gets completely upended when these dogs show up. He is unprepared for it and unprepared for the changes it'll make in his life. But eventually, of course, they turn out to be positive, and why wouldn't they be? It's a box full of puppies at Christmas. I mean, that's going to cheer anybody up.
Right.
But the plot, the basis was inspired by the story of my own little dog, Tucker, who was a rescue dog who was dropped off still slick from birth. Brand new dog was dropped off at a shelter in a box. And they just happened to have a lactating German shepherd who had just weaned her pups. And I think they brought the box of puppies in and said something like, "Hey, remember that wild weekend at the Sigma Chi house? Because here you go." and introduced a new box of puppies, and this dog took care of them, and that's how I got my dog, Tucker, and Tucker has indeed rescued me. I was in the doldrums because I thought I was never going to adopt a dog again. But in a similar fashion to Josh and the Dogs of Christmas, my daughter rescued Tucker. She actually runs a rescue in Denver, and she called me and said, I'm bringing you this dog, and that let me know that, you know, you lose a dog and you say, I can't go through that again. And then you get another dog and you think, what was I thinking? Why didn't I do this before?
It's interesting how Josh is, in a sense, exactly the right choice for somebody who can be kind of transformed by this experience. In that, I mean, he's by all evidence a great guy, but someone who's basically never owned a dog before, and a very typical guy in the sense of having a lot of deep feelings, but not particularly good at expressing them, and some other ways in which you know, he's exactly the kind of guy whose sort of barriers are almost inevitably going to come down. What else did you think about in creating this central character of Josh and making him interesting and someone familiar to us and yet not just kind of a cookie-cutter caricature?
Yeah, when I wrote The Dogs of Christmas, what I was intrigued by is how we in today's society seem to be both more social and less social. We're spending more time on social media. We're texting people. We're emailing people. But we're spending less and less time with people. It's easy now to spend your entire day sitting in front of the computer and feel as if you've had a lot of great social interactions. And I suppose by some definitions you have, but you're not interacting with anything but your fingertips, perhaps. You know, you're just not, and you're very coldly exchanging these text messages. I wanted to write a story about someone who is going into that world sort of not involuntarily, but willingly, and in doing so. Was losing his heart a little bit. And then along come the Dogs of Christmas and pull him back out. You know, you can't text with your dog. You have to take your dog for a walk. You have to interact with your dog. And I wanted to write about how you can find the human side of yourself if you just know where to look. And if where to look is nosing you because he wants to go out in the yard for a walk. I think that's a pretty helpful thing in the world.
We're speaking with W. Bruce Cameron about his newest book called The Dogs of Christmas. Another very, very important character in this book is Carrie, who works at the local animal shelter. And one of the things that's so striking, I hate to give too much away, but you should say that the very first encounter between Josh and Carrie, which is over the phone, is not a very positive one. And and actually, in some ways, we're not given all that positive a first impression of who Carrie is and what she's like. Tell us about her and about this first encounter which Josh has with Carrie over the phone.
Yeah, Josh, you know, Josh has these puppies and feels like the thing you do when you have puppies is you call the animal rescue people and they come get them. As far as he's concerned, that's the method. He doesn't know any different. Carrie, when she answers the phone, is very cold toward him because what Josh doesn't know is that in animal rescue, they don't have the resources to sit and bottle feed puppies. And in this case, what would be happening, and again, not to give too much away, but Josh believes that the proper course is to give over the puppies themselves and not Lucy, the lactating shepherd that he has. So that's complicated. I don't want to get into that. But Carrie's response is really cold because to her, what Josh is saying is, I'm gonna drop off these puppies for you to euthanize, because that's what would have to happen. They can't do it any other way. And a lot of people don't know that about dropping puppies off at a. They have to be weaned, or their chances of survival are nil at a shelter. Yeah, Carrie, I know a lot of people in animal rescue, and Carrie is sort of a compilation of those people. They're very strong-willed. They have seen enough startlingly inhuman behavior on the part of people abandoning or abusing animals, and they have to have a strong spine to put up with that. And that is Carrie. She comes off very abrasive at first.
Absolutely.
Because she's very protective of the dogs.
Absolutely. And so exasperated with people, and especially someone as clueless as Josh, who is completely clueless when it comes to this new situation in which he finds himself. And yet then the first time we meet Carrie in person, which is when she actually makes her way to his rather remote home to see these puppies for herself, and with the puppies, she is as warm and cuddly and loving and tender-hearted as anyone could possibly be. And I thought that was really intriguing. It's probably something that we've seen before, in a sense, but I think you do an especially good job of painting that picture very persuasively of someone who can interact with a box of puppies very differently than she interacts with a whole lot of human beings in her life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and from the moment he sees her, Josh he's pretty interested in Carrie, and he immediately sets out to try to court her very awkwardly and does a really poor job. It feels very real to my own life, where, you know, in the courtship phase of my life, I've always given myself pretty much Fs. I've never been very good at it. And Josh is sort of like that. He's just not very good at trying to entice this woman. You know, she's over there to see the dogs of Christmas, but he wants her to be around to see him. Hmm. And I think one of the most fun things I've written is this slow dance between Carrie and Josh, where we're just not sure if Carrie's interested in Josh. He seems to blow it every time he talks to her, and yet she keeps coming back. What does that mean? That's the kind of stuff that feels very real to me in romance.
Mm, absolutely. Another whole layer to this book has to do with Josh and his own family. And with many of his family members, he has either complicated or distant relationships. And this is also something that I think you do a really good job of painting very realistic portraits here of these relationships fraught with various complexities or difficulties of one kind or another. Tell us a little bit about where that comes from, or maybe just try to describe the care with which you tried to describe these relationships and make them feel so authentic.
Yeah, when I was writing the Dogs of Christmas, what I wanted to portray was a man, and this Josh, who is has built up a defensive wall against the world without really realizing it. He thinks he is embracing the important things of life and keeping them alive, but what he's really doing is refusing to move on. He just can't seem to cope with the fact that his family doesn't live in the house where he lives. This is his childhood home that he has arranged to wind up with, and he actually bought it back on the market. So he lives in his family's home. That's kind of an odd thing for someone to do. But to Josh, it makes sense, and he wishes he had all the old Christmas decorations that his mom had, because in a way, that's his defense against the changing world, and that is his... that's where his hurt kind of comes out. He's got a lot of hurt in him because of some things that happened in his family. And that's something that Carrie can help him with, because she, in her no-nonsense ways, can sniff out these problems that he's got and expose them to the light and let him see that he needs to move on. And he manages to decide that Carrie is worth it, that he's willing to abandon some of these long-held principles and preconditions of existence that he's been wrestling with, because he is so enticed by this Carrie woman.
Hmm. Your book also takes us into the really sensitive arena of of what it means to take someone in when there is this very real possibility that someone will come along and take them right back out of your life again, particularly when it comes to something like opening your home to what might be a lost animal or a stolen animal or whatever. And I think a lot of us, if we've never walked this particular road, don't stop to think about what that would feel like, and in particular, the real danger that is there, that you are opening yourself up to an enormous load of hurt if suddenly all of this, in a sense, gets reversed in a way that is beyond your control.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons that Josh learns in The Dogs of Christmas is a lesson that dogs teach us, and that is that regardless of the circumstances, they are temporary visitors in our lives. When we adopt dogs and we bring dogs into our house, we know it's a temporary arrangement. We know that they have short lifespans. We do it anyway because of the joy they bring us. And then I really think one of the most important things they do for us is they teach us that even though life is short, it can be lived joyfully. And a lot of times I will catch myself so preoccupied with some project and so focused that I've sort of lost track of the point of life, which is to be joyful and to love life. And when I realize I'm doing that, I try to go back and live life like the dogs. I try to say that every day is worth living and that I should find something to be happy about every day, because, look, that's what dogs do. I mean, they're no matter what's going on, they're happy to be doing it. They want to get in the car. They want to get out of the car. You know, they think everything's great. Why can't we live like that? And when they're leaving us, they're leaving us with a legacy of joy and optimism that I think we should embrace. And hopefully, in The Dogs of Christmas, you know, you've got puppies at Christmas. It's a great gift book. It's a great little story that's I hope makes people happy. And makes them forget about problems for a little while and just concentrate on a sweet story at Christmas time. That's the aim.
Right. And, of course, one of the central themes of this book is one which has run through several of your previous books as well. At one point when Carrie and Josh are having what in many respects is kind of a difficult conversation about what you and I were just talking about, she is trying to explain to Josh, because being with us is a dog's purpose, Josh. We bred the species to be that way. The ones that didn't want to live with people weren't allowed to reproduce. So after thousands of years, it's literally in their blood. That is, dogs are meant to be with us. It's what makes them happy. And in a sense, when we allow it to make us happy too, you have a very, very special relationship there indeed.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you called out that segment of the book, because to me that is one of the most moving scenes in the book, because that's how I feel about dogs. I mean, a dog's purpose, a dog's journey. I wouldn't have written so many books with a dog on the cover if it weren't for the fact that I just feel that they're here with a very special purpose.
I want to make a quick mention of the fact, too, that along the way, we learn a lot about dogs. And for instance, there's a pregnant dog in this book who gives birth to pups. And there's all kinds of interesting information that we learn along the way. And as I recall, I think in your acknowledgments, there's somebody in your life who is really responsible for helping you have all of this kind of fun knowledge about body temperature and what to feed a pregnant dog and the new puppies and how to feed them. And I mean, a lot of that interesting information is like a wonderful little bonus along the way.
Yeah, I have a couple of veterinarian friends that I abuse on a regular basis by picking up the phone and calling and asking, okay, what's the story here? You know, what would happen if this happened? I continually ask them. They must get tired of getting those phone calls. But, you know, I'm an author. My job in writing The Dogs of Christmas was to tell a good story and to try to adhere to, you know, the facts about dogs, but I'm not a veterinarian. I didn't go to vet school, so when it comes time to trying to come up with this stuff, I have to turn to the experts. I would hate it if somebody read one of my books and it happens all the time. I'll get some fact wrong, generally because I thought I knew what I was talking about. So I have to be very disciplined in recognizing that I seldom know what I'm talking about, and I just my job is to write down what the smart people say. That's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great book on all kinds of different levels, and not just for what we sort of learn along the way, but for also the way in which we grow very, very attached to both the human beings and the dogs that are in this lovely book, The Dogs of Christmas, published by Forge. And W. Bruce Cameron, congratulations on yet another lovely book. I am so glad we had the chance to speak about it today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
And more from author W. Bruce Cameron in just a moment. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. In part two of today's morning show here on WGTD, I am happy to dip into the archives for what I am pretty sure is my very first conversation with best-selling author W. Bruce Cameron. The time is 8:34. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's program and this earlier conversation from The Morning Show archives. I am so excited about the opportunity to speak with W. Bruce Cameron about his novel, A Dog's Purpose, A Novel for Humans. I had heard so much about this bestseller, and now here is the opportunity to speak with its author and to learn a little bit more about this really intriguing idea of a novel written from the perspective and to some extent in the voice of a dog. W. Bruce Cameron might already be familiar to you because of his previous bestseller, 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which eventually was transformed into a hit television series of the same name starring John Ritter. And he is a well-known and award-winning humor columnist, and this latest novel is a very, very special accomplishment indeed. Again, it's called A Dog's Purpose, A Novel for Humans, and W. Bruce Cameron
We welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. What a great intro. I feel like everything's been said. We might as well just say goodbye.
Oh, I hope not. I have a lot to ask you. And I'll start with what's really quite a basic question, I suppose. To what extent do you come at this as someone who has owned and loved dogs?
Oh, I have always loved dogs. I haven't always owned one. There have been periods of time when I have been without dog, and it's a desolate feeling in some ways. Right now I have a 13-week old puppy rescue named Tucker. We have no idea what his DNA might be like, because he was dropped off at a shelter in a box as a newborn puppy and put with a lactating German Shepherd female to keep him alive until he could be weaned, and then he came to me by way of rescue, and he has ripped everything up within eyesight. As I sit here looking around my living room, I see that he's done a really good job of just ripping everything.
Lovely. And I wonder if we could try to explore the kernel of the idea of trying to write a book which would, in a sense, put you inside the mind of a dog.
And to have you
write in that particular voice. Did anything in particular spark that initial idea?
Well, yeah. There's a lot of books out there that have tried to capture, and I think done a good job of capturing how dogs think. But one distinction with a dog's purpose, this is a real dog who doesn't understand the full breadth and width of the English language. This is a dog who understands maybe 100 words. Now, the book itself, of course, is written as I'm an author, so I wrote it using more than 100 words. That'd be a pretty boring book if I did. But it's told from the perspective of a dog who can sit at your feet. You can have an entire conversation in front of it, and if you didn't say car ride, the dog didn't really notice anything of interest in your conversation. So the challenge for me was to try to capture that and to capture the joy that dogs bring to everything that happens. In Dog's Purpose, and I should note, I mean, the Dog's Purpose is the story of a dog who is reincarnated several times, and through the course of his lives comes to believe there must be an ultimate purpose to his life. So the story of a dog's purpose sort of addresses the question, what if your dog never really dies, with the answer, here's a novel for humans. But during the course of his life, he starts off as a feral dog, cut off from people, alone, and then we see it as a pretty brutal life. But for a dog, he's joyous regardless of what's happening. So he brings all of that to the conversation, and that was part of it as well. What would it be like to be so full of joy all the time, no matter what's going on?
And you wanted to depict that joy of life in the typical dog in several different arenas. I mean, because dogs can live very different kinds of lives depending on whether or not, first of all, they are owned by anyone or not, and whether or not those owners really care about them or not. And
yes.
And in a sense, you're trying to show us what is always the same about most dogs, those different possibilities.
Yes, exactly. Even as a feral dog, the dog and a dog's purpose finds himself drawn to people. Doesn't understand the draw, but it is instinctive. They want to be with us. They want to love us. And so his next life, when he's their family pet named Bailey, he comes to meet an 8-year-old boy named Ethan, and the two of them fuse instantly when they see each other, and they fall in love instantly. And so the life of Bailey really helps us see from a dog's eyes what it's like to be with a person and what it's like to meet a person who becomes the centerpiece of your world. Just as so many dogs are loyal to one person or one or two people, this is what happens with the dog Bailey and a dog's purpose.
Hmm. One of the interesting things about your book at the beginning, before we've even entered the novel itself, is reading the list of acknowledgments. And clearly you have written this book with more than just your own experience as the owner of many dogs through your life.
Yeah,
but you have really reached out to people who could really share some bona fide expertise on how a dog thinks and feels. Tell us about that quest to understand more about the mental and emotional lives of dogs and how that specifically informed how you crafted this novel.
That's right. It takes a village to write a Cameron novel. Yeah, I looked at when I set out to write a dog's purpose, very, very often it felt to me like I could look into the eyes of a dog and see an old soul. You know, some dogs seem so wise, wise beyond their species, one might say. But when I started struggling with how do dogs really see the world, I started doing research. I read a lot of different books. Desmond Morris, Michael Crichton come to mind, Temple Grandin, of course, Marty Beckerman, Dina Safiris, and people like that. So I talked to dog trainers, and I became involved with a search and rescue dog website, because during one of the lives in the book, the dog becomes a search and rescue dog and comes to believe during the course of that life, oh, well, this must be my purpose. This is the highest order of a dog, is to be a working dog and to move beyond being a family pet, though in his soul he feels like being a family pet was emotionally the high point of his life. Now he feels like he's serving mankind. So I didn't really know anything about search and rescue, and I read the manual, the search and rescue manual, and I connected with people who were involved in search and rescue. So it took research to do something that sounds pretty easy, which is to just write about life from the viewpoint of a dog. But it actually took quite a bit of concentrated research to get a dog's purpose, to have that authentic voice that I was fortunate enough to hit, so that people like Temple Grandin and Marty Beckerman say, oh, yeah, he got this one right.
Hmm. That does have to make you feel good, doesn't it?
Oh, as an author, you try, and you don't know if you're going to get it, and you do know you're going to make mistakes, and apparently, readers are so particular. I've heard from some readers that say, oh, there's a mistake here or a mistake there in a dog's purpose, and of course they're right. No work is perfect, but I really think that for a lot of people, emotionally, a dog's purpose really gets that connection, that connection between people and dogs, the sense that true love never really dies.
Hmm. One of the things that I found really intriguing, and this is as someone who's owned a lot of dogs and fancied that he understood dogs pretty well, but your book really helped me understand the importance of trying to be consistent with dogs, and yet at the same time, in some ways, how impossible it is to be really all that consistent. I mean, that from a dog's point of view, a lot of what we do or say does not really make sense.
Yeah.
And that often we might do things that to our dog might just seem like a terrible mistake we're making. I mean, like putting them in the garage for the first time for the day instead of having them be in the house where they'd always been before. Well, surely that's a mistake that my humans are making, and they're not in a position, nor are we in a position to convey to them that, no, this is a new way of doing things that we have to do, and this is the new right way of doing things to our dogs. It just seems like a terrible, sad mistake.
Yeah, you know, in a dog's purpose, what we learn is that we are really the center of their universes, and clearly, if the universe were unstable, it would be unhappy for us, and it's unhappy for the dogs. And as you said, it's a great example. Bailey believes, you know, surely wherever they're going, it would be improved by having a dog there. And yet Ethan has to go to school. They adopt the dog over the summer, so Bailey believes, oh, this is what life is like. It's great. I play with my boy every day, and then one day he's locked in the garage and everybody leaves the house and it's completely quiet, and it is just absolutely unfathomable and frankly even agony for the dog to be left behind like this. He just doesn't understand. So sure, you know, to the extent possible, if we could just as humans be consistent, which I don't think is an attribute of humanity, quite frankly, but if we could be consistent with our animals, it would make it a lot less stressful for them. They're just trying to figure us out. They just want to make us happy.
Exactly. One of the funniest things is when Bailey, as he is called in one of the portions of the book, has managed to get from the garage into the house and caused all kinds of trouble in there while everybody was gone. So when they come back, they are absolutely beside themselves with the mess that has been made. Bailey, Mom called to me sternly. Bad dog, Bailey, the boy said crossly. I was astounded at this false accusation. Bad? I'd been accidentally locked in the garage, but was more than willing to forgive them. Why were they scowling at me like that, shaking their fingers at me? Moments later, I was back in the garage helping the boy who picked up everything I'd played with and put most of it into the trash container I'd knocked over. Mom came out and sorted through the clothing, taking some into the house with her, but no one praised me for discovering where the items had been hiding. I really love the fact that, I mean, as you said before, you chose to utilize the full range of words at your disposal, but to funnel those words through what might somewhat resemble the perspective of a dog.
Yeah, and he, Bailey, has a really tempestuous relationship with Smokey the cat, who, and this really happened in real life to my daughter's dog and cat. The cat manages to open the cupboard and knock bags of potato chips onto the floor for the dog to rip into. So when the people come home, they don't understand how the dog could possibly have gotten up into the cabinet and gotten the potato chips down, but nonetheless, the evidence is there. And they're scolding the dog. They're saying, you know, even though Smokey the cat gave him the potato chips, they're scolding the dog, bad dog Bailey. And he looks at the cat and he thinks, well, Smokey was a bad cat. That's his
bad
conclusion.
Absolutely. One very sort of touching moment not long after Bailey has been gathered up by this new family is he realizes how different this experience is from an experience earlier, or let's say in a previous life, when he is just one of a number of dogs in a pound or a shelter. And he is thinking to himself as he plays with Ethan, when I lived in the yard, Senora loved me, but now I realized it was a general love aimed at all the dogs in the pack. She called me Toby, but she didn't say my name the way the boy whispered Bailey, Bailey, Bailey into my ear at night. The boy loved me. We were the center of each other's worlds. Do your experts tell you that it really is possible for a dog to make those kind of distinctions?
You know, that one is just a conclusion I have from having lived with dogs. When I wrote A Dog's Purpose, I kept very much in mind all the dogs that I'd grown up with, and you know, how some of them seemed sort of aloof to me and were much more into my father, who was the center of the family and kind of the center of the dog world. And then my mom had a special dog. I think the dogs do get it when we might shower them with affection, but I think a dog does know which one is his person, which one does that dog really bond with. And I think that they are as in tune with us and our emotions. And when you read A Dog's Purpose, you see how the dog always knows when the people are sad or happy or angry. Even if they're not saying anything, he senses it. He senses when people are afraid. Because that's my observation, that dogs just are so completely in tune with us.
Hmm. One of the things that's striking about how the book opens is that it is this dog being born essentially out in the wild. And it's interesting how little we think about what the day-to-day life of a dog like that is like. And of course, for you as a dog owner, you're not necessarily in a position to know that. I mean, obviously none of your own dogs have had that life, or you wouldn't own them. But you seem to have embraced that with such vividness. How did you manage to do that?
Well, my daughter is co-founder of an animal rescue group in Denver, and works a lot with stray dogs, street dogs, feral dogs, and of course, feral dogs, especially if they've been feral for a long time, they are really fearful. I mean, it's not as if they've been set free and they're living a happy, footloose life. Feral dogs are afraid because they don't have a person, and we bred them to be our companions, and when they are cut off from us, it is an unnatural state for them. They're not like cats who can jump back into being hunter-killers and survive. Scavenging for garbage and living in the streets and being subjected to all the diseases and dangers of a feral life must be awful. And, of course, again, the dogs, in a dog's purpose, are full of joy, even under those circumstances. But it was significantly difficult and sort of heartbreaking to write about a dog cut off from people, because that's just not their natural state.
Right. When one of Toby's siblings comes to the shelter or pound, he thinks, as he looks at her in such a sad state, this was what happened to dogs who tried to live in the world without people. They become beaten down, defeated, starved. Sister was what we all would have become if we had stayed in the culvert.
Yes.
Fortunately, most of this book is a joyous, wonderful affirmation of how wonderful it is to own a dog, of how much they give to us, even as we give so much to them. And it's one of a very few books that have inspired tears. And I want to really heartily endorse this beautifully crafted novel called A Dog's Purpose. And it's written by W. Bruce Cameron, published by Tom Doherty. Bruce Cameron, a great pleasure and honor to speak with you about your wonderful book.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Again, this interview about A Dog's Purpose comes from several years ago. Part one of today's morning show, which I hope you heard, was a conversation just recorded this week with W. Bruce Cameron about his most recent book, just released in paperback, called The Dogs of Christmas. There are all kinds of special, exciting things going on this weekend here in southeastern Wisconsin, including performances of George Frederick Handel's Messiah at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, this great oratorio performed in its entirety. This weekend is also the Christmas Festival at Carthage College, A Wondrous Gift is Given. This is the opening weekend of The Sound of Music, the great Rodgers and Hammerstein collaboration, their last. This is the first of three weekends of performances at the Theater Guild of The Sound of Music. This is also the final weekend of performances of a production by the Lakeside Players of Kenosha at the Rodie Opera House in downtown Kenosha of Ernest Thompson's On Golden Pond, which most people know first as a beautifully crafted film which starred Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn. Eventually adapted for the stage, and it has been experienced by audiences all over the country and received with great acclaim. I thought, in honor of this final performance of On Golden Pond by the Lakeside Players, I'd play for you the absolutely sublime musical theme which opens the film. This is music of David Gruzin. We want to remind you that if you're interested in ticket information about On Golden Pond, you can call the Lakeside Players. Their phone number is 657-7529, 657-PLAY. Here is that music from the film to On Golden Pond.
David Grusin's main theme to On Golden Pond. And again, that is performed for a final weekend of performances at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha, 514 56th Street. Call 657-PLAY for more information. Tomorrow on the morning show, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And on Monday, you'll be hearing from Devin Brown, the author of a beautifully crafted new biography of J.R. Tolkien, who, of course, is well known around the world for his books like The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support is also given from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at Carthage.